Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the papers. And it's a lively one today, starting with the Sunday Independent, which has Niamh Horan has a row here between The Israeli ambassador, Dana Ehrlich, rounds on President and Simon Harris in interview. She's alleging that they have, quotes, fostered anti-Semitism. The headline is Higgins rejects call to not speak at Holocaust event, and the strap there, Higgins confirms he will attend ceremony, and we'll get into that properly in a minute. They have a side off lead there as well. Harris facing big decisions as TDs start to scramble for top jobs. So they're saying here he's going to, Gatovitz-Keita says he's going to have to decide between Helen McEntee and Peter Burke to become the next enterprise minister, and whoever misses out will get a beefed up Department of Media. Fianna Fáil's Mary Butler to be elevated to cabinet, most likely disability and children's minister. I think some people think that putting disability and children together is slightly optically not great, given that disabled people do get bothered about kind of being infantilized, but I presume it's just a matter of that's what works to put together. They're saying Norma Foley for Social Protection and Rural Affairs, which we have heard. Mary Butler also talk of her becoming the whip. The Sunday Times counsels to face crackdown on housing targets. So Hugh O'Connell is writing about a new office within within the Department of Housing to have a strategic housing and infrastructure delivery office to turbocharge home delivery. The Business Post is leading with the cap in Dublin Airport. So major shift, they say. Leaders finally back minister to solve airport cap row. And indeed, it said in here, I hadn't seen this, that in the programme for government, it says that we will work with stakeholders to achieve our objective of lifting the passenger cap as soon as possible. So clearly, the expectation that the new government are going to make that happen. The Irish Mail on Sunday, John Lee is writing, the Israeli trade ban will be dropped to appease Trump. So he is saying that the Grand Coalition will drop the Occupied Territories Bill, and it says inside in that story, it says that it will be pointed out to people that it is in fact unconstitutional, that it would take years to get through. So maybe that's one way of kind of putting it on the long finger. And the Sunday World is leading with GAA catfish probe launched by cops. So police confirmed to the Sunday World that they have begun formal harassment investigation into woman exposing the Two Johnnies podcast. This is the so-called GAA catfisher, and the Two Johnnies did a follow-up on their hugely successful podcast about that recently, and it seems that the catfisher has resumed activities. Okay, our panel this morning, Larry Donnelly is a law lecturer at the University of Galway. Harry McGee is political correspondent with the Irish Times. Brenda Power is a columnist at the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. And Suzanne Rogers is research and policy analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brian.
Harry McGee, could you, being fair to everybody, take us through this unseemly spat between, it seems to be a throuple, if you will, between the outgoing Israeli ambassador and the president mainly, but the Taoiseach has also been dragged into it.
Absolutely, being fair to everybody, I don't think the subjective view of me being fair to everybody, I think, will apply. I think some people will think that I'm not being fair. But essentially, this emanates from an invitation that the President, Michael D. Higgins, got to attend the National Holocaust Memorial Day commemoration in the Mansion House, which takes place next Sunday. And he received the invitation from Holocaust Education Ireland. And that has spawned the mother of a row involving the Israeli government and its ambassador to Ireland, Dana Ehrlich.
And I think some leading members of the Jewish community in Ireland.
Who've asked him not to attend. And they are saying that he might use this as a political platform, essentially, you know, that he might stray into condemning the Israeli invasion of Gaza and the attendant loss of human life, 45,000 and counting, and hopefully there's a ceasefire that would be put into application today to put a stop to all that. But essentially the charge they're making against him is that he will essentially politicise the event and draw analogies between what's happening in Gaza now and what happened in the Holocaust, which many which Jewish people and indeed many Israelis would see as something that would be totally terrible to do now. I mean, there's no suggestion that he is going to do that in his speech. So the difficulty is that...
Yeah, and just to give people the kind of language that the outgoing Israeli ambassador has used, she says about the president, I'm hesitant in saying anti-Semitic, but I am saying he is anti-Israel. And she says he fosters incitement, which is concerning. And she thinks that dismissing anti-Semitism, dismissing the concerns of the Jewish community here. So, yes, I think it fosters anti-Semitism. And she says he has wrongly criticised Israel as well. And obviously the president would strongly denies all that. And I will give his side of things in a minute. So it's very strongly worded stuff.
It is. And it goes back to this charge of anti-Semitism and the kind of the blurring of the lines. I mean, the president and the Taoiseach and many Irish government ministers will claim that their comments are directed at Israel and Israel alone and what the state of Israel is doing. When you're talking about anti-Semitism, you're expressing discriminatory remarks in relation to Jewish people. And they say that there is never any intent to do anything like that, that their arguments are directed towards Israel. And
they would say Israel. They have been very firm against
They have. And the president himself, several months ago, when an Israeli minister accused Ireland of being an anti-Semitic nation, said that that was a deep slur on the Irish people. But it's something that the many members of the Jewish cabinet, including the ambassador, continue to say. And she said it again in this independent interview with Niamh Horan. It must be stressed, actually, in the state that the president issued a very long statement to the Sunday Independent on foot of this. And the thing that kind of struck me, Brendan, when I was reading it is that, number one, he was invited to attend this event. He didn't go off his own volition. And this is the seventh time in a row that he has been invited to address this event. And he obviously addressed it last year as well, seemingly without any controversy. And he is a very experienced politician. He knows the lie of the land. And even though, of course, many of his comments for an office that's supposed to be above politics have strayed into the political realm, I think he has the nous not to... Not to make this a speech about what's happening in Israel now, rather than a speech that recalls what happened in Europe 80 years ago, which was terrible and must be commemorated according to its own lies.
Yeah, and to say that Holocaust Education Ireland, who organised this event, their latest statement is, we are grateful for the support and participation of the President and of a number of Taoiseach and government ministers on behalf of the state over the years. Brenda, you picked this story as well.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure it's true, Harry, to say that there was no controversy, because part of the objection that they have, that the Jewish Representative Council and I think the Chief Rabbi have to the President attending this year, is the fact that they say he used last year's speech to lecture, that's their word, lecture them on Gaza, and they said this is basically, to us, this is a funeral. And that kind of language that he used last year was not appropriate. And they pointed to a number of issues that have arisen, even within the past year, for instance, where he accused the Israeli embassy of having circulated a letter, a very chummy letter, I would say, that he wrote to the Iranian president, wishing him all the best on behalf of the Irish people in his endeavours, and then accused the Israeli government of having circulated that, whereas, in fact, the Iranians had put it on their own website. I mean, if the voices of people like the Jewish Representative Council, Maurice Cohen, and the Chief Rabbi, are reluctant to have him speak. I think it'd take a bit of a brass neck to go ahead. I mean, it's a bit, reminds me a bit of Donald Trump saying, I'm going to protect women whether they like it or not. I'm going to sympathise with the Israelis whether they like it or not. I would have thought in the circumstances, given that this has turned into a major row, that the thing for him to do is to step back.
Okay. And just, again, to be fair, right, I had a look at his speech from last year. And actually, there's a minimal mention of Gaza, I would have said. He talks about, at one point in the speech, he talks about, as we come together today to remember the Holocaust, we should talk about the trauma of recent events. He starts by saying the appalling atrocities which took place on 7th of October, perpetuated by Hamas. He talks about the violence of that action, the killing, the abuse and abduction of hostages. He says it was horrific, morally reprehensible. Then he goes on to say, since 7th of October, too many lives, and particularly those of women and children, have been lost. But he then calls for an immediate ceasefire, the release of all hostages, to commence the task of achieving such a lasting and meaningful peace as can provide security for Israel, while at the same time realising the rights of the Palestinian people. And that is pretty much I'm leaving out bits for brevity, but that is pretty much the how he dealt with Gaza in the speech. So, look, just to be fair to everybody. Larry.
Yeah, I mean, I think he should go. I think what is an awkward situation, I think he could see as an opportunity. I mean, look, this is an individual whose public life, and again, whether you agree with his politics or not, I think it's indisputable that a guiding light of his career in public service has been to eradicate racism, anti-Semitism, all these things. He's passionate about these issues. I think he can clarify his position in the speech. I think he should, basically saying that, look, I've opposed anti-Semitism. I hate and I abhor every iota of it and distinguish it between the Israeli state. And also, he might use this as an opportunity again, because he's somebody who's committed to nonviolence, he might issue something of a rebuke to what I found to be disturbing comments made by some in public life here on October 8th, just after the horrific events of October 7th.
What about to Brenda's point about that thing about the accusing the Israelis of circulating the letter? I'm not saying it's anti-Semitism, but, you know, it was disinformation, which the ambassador does accuse him of. There was also, he suggested at one point, I think kind of botched, in a botched way, and I think there was a climb down on it, that the Israel were planning settlements in Egypt, which was entirely wrong as well.
I think those comments were regrettable. I'm not going to see, the president can defend himself on that front. That's not something certainly that I would have put into the public sphere. But again, he has been invited. He's done this for years. This is who he's about. I think he can clarify his position. But one thing, just to make a point about the ambassador's comments and the ambassador's perception, and I've been saying this a number of times to different people. I was in the United States over the Christmas period,
yeah.
And her perceptions and the things she's saying about Ireland, they are gaining real traction in the United States. Ireland is increasingly perceived to be, and again, I don't believe this to be the case, but it's increasingly perceived in the United States to be the most anti-Semitic country in the West. And that is a very, very dangerous development for us at many, many levels.
So now, are you talking about among the kind of rarefied academic circles, or is this on the street, regular people?
Brendan, anyone who knows me knows I don't hang around in rarefied academic circles. These are ordinary people I meet, down to people I was in Washington, D.C., down to people I met in pubs. And one of the things that they were constantly saying to me was, what is the story with Ireland and Israel? Because again, one of the things that also I think people here don't grasp, and this brings up Gaza again, is just how radically differently the Middle East is perceived in the United States. And again, my own view would be much more inclined to the way things are perceived here, but it is a totally different story in the United States. And again, facing into all that we're facing into, this is a new wrinkle that we really don't need.
And we'll come back to that aspect of things in a while. Suzanne.
I mean, I had to go back to, there's a quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which is, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. So I think it's possible to not be anti-Semitic and at the same time criticise or have a discussion with what is happening in in Israel, in Gaza at the same time. Like, and I'm not being flippant, but say, for instance, like, it's possible to be a Smiths fan but not a Morrissey fan at the same time. You know, when you can hold two very, very different things in your head at the same time, like, to not allow a conversation about, we're blowing up children in their beds because of the bogeyman hiding under the bed, to say that we can't even have that discussion and immediately accuse me of being anti-Semitic, to shut down all conversation, all type of discussion or debate. So I just think the president
should...
But you
can say that conversation has been shut down in Ireland. God almighty.
But as you said, that's the thing. If you have that conversation, it's presumed then that you are... anti-Semitic. It's presumed that we are anti-Semitic as a country.
But Suzanne, that conversation is happening in every Western country. And why are we the ones being singled out?
Which is weird, because our Jewish population here is tiny. Like, I just looked it up before. Like, according to the World Jewish Congress, people who either maybe Jewish ethnicity or Jewish faith, it's 2,700 individuals. So I'm kind of going, you know, this is, and I don't want to undermine it at all what their lived reality may be in this country. Absolutely not. But for that, you know, two opposing ideas, like, you know, if the president goes to a Holocaust memorial, that is a thing in and of itself. As you said, you know, these events happened. They are remembered, and that is a good thing to remember. And at the same time, does it mean that you can't have a conversation about what's happening?
I suppose, is the issue with people, though, Suzanne, that why is he having that conversation? Why? I delineated what he brought up about Gaza. Why is he having that at a Holocaust memorial? Because the new definition of anti-Semitism that we have now adopted, the various kind of outcomes and examples they give of that is a kind of a conflating of all Jewish people with the actions of the State of Israel is, according to that definition, they or according to their interpretation of it, is a form of anti-Semitism.
But it can't be. You know, I mean, you do have to distinguish between...
I don't think it's up to you to say what anti-Semitism is, but Harry, and this is...
But you can't, I mean, you have to try to define it according, as objectively as you can. Yeah. And according, I mean, anti-Semitic is a form of racism against a particular people and against a particular race. Anti-Israel, it's criticism of a state. In the same way that people would have criticised the US invasion of Iraq.
Fair enough.
And the Middle East, Brenda. Years ago.
But I was going to say, it is clear, though, that Jewish people living here feel that it is anti-Semitic. And that is one of the definitions, or I suppose one of the thrust of the hate speech laws and hate crime legislation, that where the subject of the attack feels that they have been... That they're being targeted on a racial basis. I mean, what the chief rabbi said about the president was that he has neglected to acknowledge the scourge of anti-Semitism in Ireland, or even to do anything to address it. Clearly, if they feel they are the targets, and some of the instances that Dana Ehrlich mentions about getting pictures of the victims of the 7th of October with her name on it, blood on her face, saying you'll be next. I mean, if you feel targeted by that sort of hate, you're entitled to call it anti-Semitism.
Yeah, but not to conflate that with anything to do with the president. And again, in fairness to the president, he said in Manchester last year, this is in the statement today, the Irish Jewish community must not be dragged into being asking whose side are you on. It's a very unfair burden to put on the Jewish community. So he is dealing with that precise issue, which is within the now the ambit of anti-Semitism, of conflating all Jews with Israel. It also points out in this statement that 30 years ago he went to meet the Lord Mayor of Cork, Gerald Goldberg, and Goldbergs are a very well-known family in Cork, but they had been, that family had been run out of Limerick in pogroms, and the president at that time, as a member of the government, apologised for all the families of the Jewish community then. So he does have a record here.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me this morning when I was reading this, Brendan, was, say, if he were not to go to the commemoration next Sunday, I mean, that would be an acknowledgement in some form, you know, that he... or the government were culpable of making statements that could be construed as anti-Semitic. You know, and again, I go back to the very basic point that you have to distinguish between the state of Israel and the Jewish people. I'm sure that Jewish people in Ireland feel besieged at the moment, and I'm sure that some individuals have been at the receiving end.
So perhaps then would we say, don't talk about the state of Israel when you're at the Holocaust Memorial next week. Don't talk about the state of Israel and their actions right now. Would that be appropriate?
Well, I think you also have to distinguish between the Holocaust and what's happening now as well. And I think you have to be very careful in terms of
Larry, briefly, and then I want to go to Israel.
I think to do that would be to ignore the elephant in the room. That's why I say looking at this as an opportunity to clarify where he stands and to send that message. Again, look what his entire career is about. That's what's defined him since the beginning of his career. Make these points, make them strongly, and leave people in no doubt as to where he stands.
Well, there's lots of pictures of the president before he was president floating around with his Palestinian keffiyeh. So, I mean, I don't know
I have not seen those pictures, but okay. Obviously, as we mentioned there, as we speak, there is a ceasefire being implemented in Gaza. So let's go to Tel Aviv now and Sky News Middle East correspondent Alistair Bunkle. Good morning, Alistair.
Good morning.
So the ceasefire looked in doubt early this morning. Talk us through how events have unfolded so far today.
Yeah, so the ceasefire was due to begin at 8:30 a.m. here, but by that point, Hamas had not handed over the names of the three hostages that were due to be released today. And so Benjamin Netanyahu, who met with some of his security officials last night, told the Israeli military to carry on striking Gaza. And we saw shortly after 8:30, black smoke rising over northern Gaza. Hamas took responsibility for it, really, saying that it was a technical fault, their end. They didn't really elaborate. But a couple of hours later, those three names were handed to the Israeli government. And at 11:15, the ceasefire came into force. And it's the early hours of it, but it seems to be sticking for now.
OK, who are the three hostages?
There's Emily Damari, who is a dual British national who was taken at Kfar Aza. Her mother has been pleading with the British government for her to be released, and it looks like she will come out this afternoon. Doron Steinbecker is a second of the hostages as well to come out, and Romy Gorin is the third. So three young women. We don't know their condition. We expect that they will be alive, but nobody has heard their condition for many months.
Alistair, how would you describe the mood or the atmosphere in Tel Aviv today?
Uncertain. You know, I mean, obviously, like in Gaza, this is being welcomed, this ceasefire. Not by everybody in Israel. There's plenty in Israel who think it amounts to a surrender against Hamas. They believe that Hamas is not defeated, which is true. They're not defeated, but they think it will allow Hamas the ability to regroup. But in Tel Aviv, which is a more secular, liberal society, and it's been the focus of a lot of the marches over the last year and a half. Yeah, there's hope, but they've seen this morning how fragile this ceasefire can be. And so they won't allow themselves to celebrate until all of the hostages are brought home.
How is the rest of the day expected to unfold?
We haven't been given an exact time for when the hostage prisoner exchange will happen. Bear in mind, there will be about 90 Palestinian prisoners who will also be released, many of them women and children, many of them being held in Israeli prisons without any charge whatsoever. They will be a part of the exchange today. We thought it was going to happen around 4:30 here. There's an indication that still might be the sort of timeline we're looking at. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's a little later on, a little sort of after darkness has fallen here. So it could be early evening.
Alistair, just before you go, you've been around the Middle East for a long time. You've been around conflict zones for a long time. And I suppose you develop gut feelings about things and read the runes and stuff. How confident will you be that this will get past the first 6 weeks, that this will get to phase two at all?
Well, I'm not very confident. I think there's so much that could go wrong. The Israeli government has always maintained, without deviating, that they want to retain the right to carry on fighting in Gaza. But I really think that it's going to be interesting to watch how President Trump plays it. I think there have been indications that he's not going to give Benjamin Netanyahu a free rein to do what he wants. Trump has made it clear that he wanted this ceasefire deal before he took office, and looks like he'll get his way. And Trump's team over here, who are spending a lot of time over in the region, not just in Israel, they want this to happen. They want it to stick. They want to move into the second phase and third phase. And, you know, if Netanyahu is in any way intimidated by Trump, as quite a lot of Middle Eastern leaders are, then it might be that the US president, for all of his other controversies, the cult of his personality actually gets this into something a bit more long lasting.
So who knew? Who knew? In Trump, we place our hope and trust. Sky News Middle Eastern correspondent Alistair Bunkle, thank you so much for taking the call, Alistair. I know things are probably very busy there. Our panel are staying with us, Larry Donnelly, Harry McGee, Brenda Power and Suzanne Rogers. We'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel still here, Larry Donnelly, Harry McGee, Brenda Power and Suzanne Rogers. And Brenda, we have a government, or just about. The piece you've picked out today is Alison O'Connor in the Sunday Times. Healy Razor inside the tent. This will be fun.
Yes, I know. Do you know who else is writing about it today? Ryan Tuberty, saying, do not underestimate the Healy Rays. He's referring back to an interview where he heard somebody interviewing them with a sort of a smile in their voice, kind of mocking. He said, these are serious players. The papers are full today of the art of the deal and the various shenanigans that went on about creating this, forming the new government. There's a quote in the Sunday Times describing the new grand coalition as MAGA with a fada, peaked caps and an Irish gombeen twinge. Now the story is there's an agreement that it will be a general policy, that there will be no individual deals done or no benefits to the constituencies of those who are elevated to the cabinet and junior ministry.
So the Healy Rays are gone in for the good of the country.
But actually Shane Ross has a very interesting little anecdote in his piece in the Sunday Independent describing how these deals don't leave a paper trail. He said when he was negotiating as Minister for Sport with the government that Michael
Lowry was supporting from the outside. Yeah.
He said, that one of the big sort of goodies that you could bring back to your constituency is maybe announcing a new sports club. He said, so more than likely, someone like Lowry would get the nod to announce it ahead of their own TDs in the area.
Yeah.
So that's how that they will be able to spin their involvement, I suppose, as something very beneficial for Kerry. I don't think anybody doubts that they're going to do what they can for their constituency, because apparently when I think it was when Jackie John O'Donoghue Jackie Healy Ray said I'll be looking after Kerry, and now they are in the same position whereby they will have their own constituency.
I think
rivals,
John O'Donoghue was tormented for years by that man, wasn't he? And then John O'Donoghue got made Kiam Corla, and I think Jackie Healy Ray said, John, relax. I'll keep an eye on things in the kingdom.
Michael Cahill, the new Fianna Fáil TD for Kerry, who's based down in South Kerry, near to where John O'Donoghue used to be, has given the Healy Rays that very same reassurance. Don't worry, guys. on your behalf. So history is kind of repeating itself to a certain extent. It's kind of strange because Brenda referred back to 1997, and there were four independent TDs who supported the government back then. And the quid pro quo for that was they all got kind of constituency deals. The Healy Rays, amongst other things, got a fine new road that linked the Cork Killarney Road to Kilgarvan. Harry Blaney got the new Blaney Bridge that connected two relatively remote, not so remote anymore, peninsulas in Donegal. So everything was focused on the constituency.
Yeah, Sinead McSweeney reminded us all last week here that when she was working for, I forget what department, she was the Department of the Marine as an advisor, she was dispatched down to Kerry to go basically looking at the siting of some pier that was being built for Jackie Healy Ray. So things weren't as kind of hidden in those days, clearly.
No, and there will be. I think this, as Brenda was referring to, the sports capital grants will be very interesting to see when they arrive, to see which counties have benefited from the munificence of the Minister for Sports. And I'm sure the constituencies of independent TDs will feature. But this time around, it's to do with getting them inside the tent. giving them all some kind of role in government, from super juniors to juniors. I'd say a few of the independents will also end up being, Barry Heenan has been talked about as a deputy chief whip. I'd say there'll be one or two chairs of committees as well. So it's keeping them inside.
So do you think that
they
took jobs over constituency deals? Is that the feeling?
I think they have taken jobs, but they've also looked after the constituencies. I mean, the Healy Rays have forged a reputation on being the can-do people in Kerry. If you want to get broadband in Kerry, or if you want to get water, or if you want to get electricity, if you want to get anything done in Kerry, they're the go-to guys in Kerry. A little bit like Michael Ring, for example, was in Mayo. So they're not going to... I mean, Dick Spring was a very good example of why you need to be a strong constituency TD in Ireland. He was a minister in government in 1987, and he almost lost his seat in Kerry because he didn't look after the constituency. He survived by only 4 votes, and he never repeated that mistake again. So you can be sure, as night follows day, that all of those independents who have been elected will also have deals, probably written in invisible ink, to look after some aspect of their constituency.
Yeah, I mean, the Healy Rays have an amazing name for constituency work. I saw several references to the fact that when you ring them, they will always ring you back.
Yeah, apparently, I read somewhere that Michael Healy rays up at 5 o'clock in the morning. He's in the office at 5. His staff come in at 5:45. He's hitting the phones, ringing people back by 8 o'clock. Suzanne, you picked out Shane Coleman in the Business Post, who is criticising the lack of oomph from the incoming government and the programme for government.
Yeah, and I mean, he stands in, I suppose, direct opposition then to Conor Skehan, who thinks it's a remarkable document. But yeah, Shane, you know, similar to that kind of, it's worthy but dull. He points out that Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty has done something similar to myself. So Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty has done a control F, continue appears 249 times. I was struck by the programme for government that a lot of it is focused on establishing a steering group or publishing a report or a strategy. So it's, I don't see anywhere where they're saying this is the thing we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it. You know, we're going to get a report. We could spend 3 years getting the report, and by the time the 3 years is in, you know, we'll review the report and then sure.
Does everything not have to be evidence based these days, though?
But I mean, surely we should be at that point already. Do you know what I mean?
Like, reckon we have the evidence.
The jury is in on that kind of stuff. So it was things like 52 published, 37 action plans, 84 strategies. I had a look through 86 examines, 33 protects. So you're kind of going, protecting what from whom? Like, you're the lads who are making the decisions. So it was a very vague. Now, having said that,
now I know there is a counter word count going around as well, that I saw some wannabe minister doing the other night. I will admit I do not have it to hand, but there is a counter word count of more action words that they can point to being in there 29 and 84 and 160 times.
But there's things like recommit, and you're there going, no, you've already committed, just deliver. So it's that sort of thing.
Brenda.
I was just going to say, Gary Murphy in the Sunday Times is saying something very similar. He said much has been made of the preponderance of words explore, examine, assess, aim, review, and consider. So there's so much conditionality in this document, it borders on the ridiculous.
Did people not vote for more of the same?
Well, he's actually saying that this government does not have a mandate, that no government has had a mandate since 1977 because nobody has had an overall majority. So they can't say they actually have a mandate.
But sure, no one's ever going to have a mandate again by that logic. Larry?
Yeah, I mean, zooming out a little bit from this, a lot of what's been discussed is inside baseball that I suppose animates political anoraks like us. But I think the government, I think, has avoided one banana skin in the sense that this didn't take longer, that they got things together. But if you look at what might trip them up in the public mind or what might catch the public mind, people who aren't following this avidly, one thing perhaps may be this issue of the allowances and for ministers for state, for which I think there's a reasonably good cause, but might make some of the people say, what's going on here? Coupled with the climate where there's so many ministers now, that might capture some of the public attention. And then the second thing is this thing that I can't quite figure out, this sort of both sides, that is independents who are affiliated to the government but also want to speak during opposition time. Both of those, I think, will stick in the public mind and say, what the hell is going on here? So these are two potential things that could be pitfalls. And it comes in, I suppose, a context in which you can almost, and I'm being glib or maybe a little bit rough here, divide the electorate in two, in the sense the people who are happy with things going, and they mostly voted for the government parties, and the issue for them is keep the show on the road, guys. We know there's turbulence, but keep the show on the road. And then on the flip side, another half who are saying, we need houses.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I think more than half saying we need
How are we going to balance the two?
Harry, let's go back to the messing is I think the word most people would use for it that has gone on over, you know, the junior ministries. People are just looking at stuff like, well, justified or not, allowances, the speaking rights thing and all that.
Yeah.
Is there a bad fog of kind of there messiness is. Around this now? As like Wednesday should be a kind of a, not a triumphant day, but it should be, you know, it should be a good day for the government. They must be furious with the independents for creating all this kind of air of messiness.
Well, it'll certainly dampen the fireworks a little on Wednesday. The Dáil is bigger. There's 174 seats in the Dáil, but then the number of junior ministers has also increased, not exponentially, but it has increased considerably. Now we have four super ministers, and it reminds us of, to a certain extent, unfortunately, of the excess of the Celtic Tiger years. During the early 2000s, when there were 20 junior ministers, and there were, you know, it has this kind of ring of jobs for the boys or something for everybody, and then with the allowances and stuff. So it looks some people like they are feathering their own nest. So that's always an unfortunate
thing. And then they
image.
Would argue that we have a bigger population than ever. Things are more complex than ever. We give out all the time about things don't work in this country and that, you know, they can't do anything, they can't do big projects and all this. Does it not make sense to have more managers responsible for particular areas in this enormous thing that is Ireland Inc.?
Famous words of Mandy Rice Davies come to mind there. They would say that, wouldn't they?
Okay, Suzanne.
Just to go back to your piece about the mandate, I mean, we saw this that I'm really conscious, like, this is one of the few governments where they can't blame the previous administration, so that they have that joy in the UK and in the US. You can blame who came before you. But it is that thing when we saw the election manifestos, like, that was, I could just immediately think of, like, the bad boyfriend or the bad girlfriend going, look, baby, I know I haven't put the bins out for 5 years. I keep leaving empty milk cartons in the fridge, but take me back. I can change. And we've kind of gone, OK, I've taken you back. And it's more of the same. Here he is on the couch cutting his toenails while you're trying to watch Coronation Street.
Is that a fair kind of metaphor? I mean, we're not going to get lost in the weeds of this metaphor, but were people screaming for them to be gone, the people who voted them back in again?
But then
were they unhappy with the boyfriend?
We seem to have this, they reckon, like, we have an aversion towards extremes. So that is exactly it. So people weren't happy. They didn't go too far out to the right, but they also didn't go too far out to the left. So as Shane Coleman goes, that's steady as she goes, keep the car on the road, keeping voters happy with something for everyone in the audience. Most of us are doing all right, so we don't really want the change that we think we want. I mean, if we were to build the 300,000 houses that this is being promised and create the 300,000 jobs that the programme for government's come, that is actually going to reduce house prices. And that really isn't what we want. We say we want it. But when you look at where all the wealth in the country is, it's all tied up in our property prices. So fair enough, you want house prices to drop for your son, but you don't want house prices to drop for the house you already own. So it is a little bit, I don't know whether we really knew what we were voting for. But I mean, again, Shane says that the independent TDs, a lot of them didn't have manifestos that you could kind of sit down and go through and read through. So it was very difficult from a national picture. If you were in their constituencies, they may have come to your door and said, this is what we're about. But it's very hard to sort of sit and compare and contrast those with their manifesto.
You're talking about ideology.
Yeah.
Well, just
would
even
you go
like,
away? Sure, ideology is practically banned in Ireland. Like, it's viewed with suspicion, isn't it?
I'm loath to cavil against such an eminence grease as Gary Murphy, but I'm still kind of stunned by his statement that the government hasn't had a mandate since 1977. Because if you look at this election result, you know, I mean, as Susan was saying there, the government did get a mandate. It was a mandate for the steady as you go, as you say, it's a centrist dad. And Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they transferred very heavily to each other. So there was a kind of a block vote for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil that almost achieved a majority. And in fairness to them, there are things that they are doing that are different from the last government. If you look at the headlines, the front pages of the three broadsheets this morning, all of them are referring to changes. You're talking about the housing in the Sunday
Times.
Mm-hmm. They're talking about this new housing unit that will put pressure on local authorities. In the Business Post, we're looking at the DAA pressing to get the 32 million cap in Dublin Airport lifted to 40 million, and the government giving them backing for that. And in the Sunday Independent, the Irish Mail on Sunday, they're also talking about the Irish government rowing back slightly on the Occupied Territories Bill in order to appease Donald Trump and the new American administration.
Harry, you're practically saying we're getting change.
No, but there will be. There
did
are changes
we or didn't
and
we vote for
when
change?
You look,
yeah.
when you look within the programme for government, a lot of it is the same as the previous programme for government, except it's been moved on a little bit. But there are things that are materially different.
But Harry, it was a low turnout, though. I mean, it was 60%, which means 40% of people said, I'm not going to vote for the government gets back in.
That's our democratic right.
Let's move on. So in terms of then the Occupied Territories Bill, and that is against a broader kind of mood, Brenda, that, and I think it's near the start of the programme for government, this talk about the threats that are there. And the big threat is Trump.
Yes.
You picked the editorial in the Sunday Times. Ireland will have to navigate a new course under Trump.
Yes, and I did. And another piece that I picked out too is Dan Mulhall's piece in the
Sunday Independent. Cool heads,
yeah,
tact and skill.
I think he's being a little bit more optimistic than we would have been expecting up to now.
Yeah.
He's basically saying, look, we have navigated Trump before.
And Dan Mulhall was our ambassador in the first Trump term.
This sort of myth that we kind of dropped the ball with regard to the Republican Party. He said that's not the case, that the diplomats in Capitol Hill would always have kept, you know, all irons in the fire. And he said, you know, That Trump needn't necessarily be as bad as we expect. That, you know, first of all, he said both Leo Varadkar and Enda Kenny established good personal rapport with him, and he says also, you know, his talk about. Secondly, the other point he's making is that he really will only have control of Congress for 2 years until the midterms.
Yeah.
And that so a lot of his plans, for instance, in respect of the corporation tax, that they're long-term projects and he may not actually succeed in them. Also that once the effect of the tariffs that he's talking about on the domestic economy becomes obvious, that that's something he might roll back from as well. But he ends up by saying, and he's 78, and really all he wants to do is play golf. And I think it was widely expected that, sort of speculated that the main reason he wanted to win was to avoid being prosecuted. He succeeded in that, now maybe he'll bugger off and play golf after.
Yeah, Anthony Scaramucci, who worked with Trump briefly, but he has that podcast with Caddy Kay, The Rest is Politics America. His line at the moment seems to be that what we're failing to understand is that Trump is now a kind of a dead man walking, that there's been Pete Trump, and now he's got, this is his last term, so the power is seeping away already. He's got 2 years to do what he can, and then once that 2 years is over, nobody's afraid of him anymore. Is that fair, Larry?
I'm loath to agree with Anthony Scaramucci, given how spectacularly wrong he was. I do think there is something of a point in that, and I just want to emphasize something that Brenda said, quoting Dan, which is the personal and how to deal with Trump. And again, I apologize if I'm sounding glib, but John Deasy, who it should be said, takes a very different tack to Dan Mulhall about U.S.-Irish relations.
And this is John DC writing in the
Business Post.
He's been writing an excellent column there recently.
He recounts a very, very, just to show the power of the personal, and I think an instructive lesson on how to deal with Trump, and sometimes indicating that the bark is a lot louder than the bite. In his first term, Trump was proposing to put a 25% tariff on Irish whiskey. And the Irish people on the ground quickly leapt, you know, the Irish government and diplomats, et cetera. And the way that they got it exempted was they first had Richie Neal, the congressman from Massachusetts, intervene. Then they went to Mick Mulvaney, Trump's chief of staff, a proud Irish American. And then they went to another Irish American in dealing with trade. And through all of this and through personal outreach, the tariff was exempted. That is, the whiskey was exempted from the tariffs. And that sort of transactional way of doing business, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that anecdote about the power of the personal, and also the continuing residual soft power of Ireland in the United States.
It's
that,
not just a Democrat thing.
No, it's not. And I think it's important to reach out to Republicans. And again, not to bring it back or belabor the point, but that's why, in that context, that's why I personally am deeply concerned about this narrative developing vis-a-vis Ireland and Israel in the United States.
Can I ask you a broader question? So, in your travels to America recently, it feels to us here as if, remember the last time Trump got in and there were crying rooms designated in the universities and everybody was having trauma therapy and all that. Are people demonstrating a bit more equanimity about it this time?
It's a really good question, and it was fascinating for me to see. With a few exceptions here and there, that climate of despair that I encountered after the 2016 election isn't there. Much more prevalent are things like, look, we survived the first one. Let's hope he succeeds. I'm an American. I hope he, you know, the things he does are going to work. I hope that his unorthodox foreign policy interventions might bear fruit. There is that air of, you know, we're going to keep going. Things will be fine. Things will be okay. And these are even among people who vigorously oppose Trump. So I think there is a little bit of that.
Okay, let's so go, let's everybody's lining up to kiss the ring now and decide actually.
There is an element to that, I think, especially at corporate level. But I would argue to you, the despair, the shock, the horror, the fear that we're seeing outside the United States is not at all duplicated within the United States.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Implications made by the CEO of TikTok in the last 24 hours. He's hosting the party for him, just as TikTok goes dark in the US. But Trump is now saying that he might give him 90 days. So I think they're trying to use that soft power that Larry has been referring to to keep TikTok alive in the US.
And Trump does seem to credit TikTok with getting his youth vote, but equally he feels he needs some time to think about whether he gets rid of it or not. Are they backpedaling furiously on TikTok in America as we speak,
I'd say if the regime had changed, I'd say TikTok would be in danger, but I think that they're emphasizing the personal. Personal relationship with him, and they're trying to get to Trump the man rather than to Trump the administration, as far as
absolutely. I think Danny Fortson in the Sunday Times has a really, really interesting piece about TikTok in the whole space. I mean, it's extraordinary. 40% of Americans under 30, TikTok is their number one source of news. I never knew it had that kind of pull, and obviously it was instrumental to Trump's election. What he's hypothesizes, though, is really interesting, and that's in the context of trade. That if Trump, as he's entitled to, gives TikTok a 90-day reprieve, and then there's some negotiations, et cetera, that TikTok could even feature in negotiations over tariffs with China, which would be very, very.
And Trump has already spoken to President Xi about TikTok and other things. I saw a great quote from Trump during the week. He just really casually said, Xi and me, we're going to get on fine because he respects me and he knows I'm effing crazy. There's method there somewhere.
That is his superpower, isn't it? That people actually don't know what exactly he's going to do. But the benefits of his unorthodox approach appear to have sort of borne fruit in the ceasefire. Barry O'Halloran's piece in the Sunday Independent. He talks about the fact that this guy Steve Witkoff, whom he sent to negotiate, first of all was told, well, it's the Sabbath and Netanyahu can't meet you today, and he said there was some salty language exchanged, and he did turn up to meet him, but said an Israeli diplomat said Witkoff isn't a diplomat, he doesn't talk like a diplomat, he has no interest in diplomatic manners and diplomatic protocols, he's a businessman who wants to reach a deal quickly and charges ahead unusually aggressively. I think that's almost a description.
He's a real estate broker. Should maybe start sending Sherry Fitzgerald or someone else to do our international deals.
I wouldn't actually agree with the portrayal of him as being a dead man walking. I mean, his administration now will be very different than the one in 2016. 2016, he had people who were in his administration who weren't Trump loyalists and who didn't have very, very strident, extreme views on things. I think it's different now. He's put in some very strong people who are very loyal to him and who are very strong. You're going to see lots of movement on immigration. Larry was referring to tariffs. I think the guy he has in for tariffs is a guy called Peter Navarro. And he's very, very strong on tariffs. And we should be a little bit worried that he might start imposing big tariffs on Ireland.
Okay, need to take a break. Larry Donnelly, Harry McGee, Brenda Power and Suzanne Rogers staying with us. Welcome back. Larry Donnelly, Harry McGee, Brenda Power and Suzanne Rogers are still with us. Suzanne Rogers, we are about potentially to get our first saint in 50 years. This story has been around for the week, but the Sunday Times have the story today of Claire Crockett. Tell us about her.
I think like a lot of us, we had never heard of Claire Crockett before this. And even when you say the first saint in 50 years, that was actually Oliver Plunkett, who was executed in 1681, but not canonised until 1975.
Wasn't exactly Gen Z.
That's it. No boomer he. And no, it is. It's really interesting. And I think what strikes me is the fact that, you know, she's very relatable. You know what I mean? She's somebody who brought up at the same, you know, time and place as us. They talk about her here that she wanted to become an actress. She was going to, you know, she had been offered a presenting role with the children's TV channel Nickelodeon, and that she gave all of that up then to become a nun at the age of 18, which, you know, really seems to have shocked her friends and family, because they saw what we all see, which is, you know, bright, vibrant. And then to presume that all of that goes to waste maybe when you enter into a vocation like this. So
apparently when she went off on the religious retreat where she had her kind of come to Jesus moment, she thought she was getting a free holiday in Ibiza for the week to go partying.
Turned out to be a retreat.
Well, I mean, the phrase "works in mysterious ways" might possibly, you know, go in here. But I spoke to somebody recently who had watched a documentary about her, because I'd only heard about her this week.
Yeah.
And they were saying that, you know, you watch her and she's got a cigarette in one hand. And, you know what I mean? So just very, very relatable. And somebody, again, who I think maybe gives us a sense of what it's like to lead a good life, but at the same time, you know, still
be a human being.
Be a human being within that space. So very much a sort of change in conversation.
Brenda, we could do with a bit more of this probably, couldn't we?
Absolutely. This is a fantastic story. Like Suzanne, I'd never heard of this woman before. She says, she was going to be an actress, and she had appeared in a couple of movies, I think. But then she said she decided, rather than being famous an actress, she said, I could become a famous nun. So she seems to have kind of predicted this for herself. There's a quote from her, said, from the time I was 12 or 13, going to parties and clubs, put myself in a really bad worldly environment. I smoke and drank. Alcohol became a problem for me, incapable of living without a packet of cigarettes. And now she's on the route to canonisation. There's a great line here too in the Sunday Times piece that depends on, obviously she needs to do some, she gets to work on the miracles now.
Yeah.
Or else she won't make it across the line. So in terms of waiting for a miracle, there's a quote from a friend of hers saying, I suppose it depends on how quickly Claire works. She could wait a few years, or she could do one now. Who knows?
Well, apparently aren't there some suggested miracles in the air of people who were told they wouldn't be able to have children.
Yeah, fertility issues apparently seems to be.
Shane O'Carrean, Northwest correspondent for RT, did a very good report on her about a week ago. And he interviewed people who said that they had received miracles from Claire Crockett. But what fascinates me as well is the whole process of canonisation, including the role of the devil's advocate, who was brought in by the Vatican to investigate the claims that this candidate is ripe for canonisation.
We need to get to that guy. We need to send Sherry Fitzgerald out to talk to him. Send a real estate broker to set him straight. Larry.
Not that I'd suggest for a minute that my church is political, but I think that a relatable saint would probably work wonders, especially a young woman, young vibrant woman, for all the reasons the other panellists have said.
Would you still be a practicing Catholic? I'm sorry, I kind of assumed nobody was, so I hope you didn't find
Not at all.
And come here, is there a sense, is Catholicism coming back into fashion in some parts of the world?
One hears those things, but, you know, still I look around, you know, when I'm in church and I'm, you know, I'm 50 now and I'm still one of the youngest people there, so there are worrying signs.
Yeah. Suzanne, briefly.
Religion is on the rise across the globe, you know, and just in general, do you know what I mean? So it isn't, we're not becoming more and more secular, we're actually becoming less and less secular. So
yeah.
Just in general.
I think Russell Brand has a lot to do with that as well. He's from Jesus now as well. The last refuge of the disgraced influencer comedian. Okay, thanks very much to my panel today for that lively hour. I think we got through it alive. Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at University of Galway. Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times. Brenda Power, columnist at the Irish Daily Mail and Sunday Times. And Suzanne Rogers, research and policy analyst at Social Justice Ireland. And now it's just after 12 noon, and we'll go to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.